I mean, I loved the place. It was so different from the valley to the alpine. Valley was ugly. The alpine was heaven. Have I said too much?
Pretty soon you'll be telling stories that can't be told. It's just mind-boggling.
Hi there, I'm Stephanie Hostetter, CEO of RE/MAX Sea to Sky Real Estate, and I'm here today with Bruce Watt, one of our realtors here at RE/MAX, and I've got Bruce in the hot seat because Bruce is starting a podcast, and we're taking today to introduce that to the world. Bruce, when did you come to Whistler?
I came up for a job interview in the fall of 73.
What kind of job were you interviewing
Well,
for?
I figured I could start as a lift attendant and hopefully get on the ski patrol. That was because I had some first aid from being a lifeguard and industrial first aid ticket and stuff like that. So
what happened? Did you
I got
start
on
as
the
a
lifts.
Lifty?
I got on the lifts. And I lived in the ghetto. The ghetto was the trailers at the bottom of the mountains for staff accommodations from day one. $30 a month for 3 meals a day and a place to sleep.
And where was that? Creekside?
It was right at the bottom of Creekside. Yeah right on the creek there. Anyway, so I got there and I hung around with the patrol, learned to ski powder, and made friends. And the next year, the patrol expanded. So a bunch of us got on the patrol. I was really lucky. I was so happy I got on the patrol. Yeah.
Nice.
And I got on the ski patrol.
Nice. At what point did you realize Whistler was going to be your home?
I think after about 10 years, you figured, you know.
10 years and you can call yourself a local?
Well, it's hard to say, yeah. You know, I think once I got married, and it's hard to say when. I mean, I loved the place. It was so different from the valley to the alpine.
Mm-hmm.
Valley was ugly. The alpine was heaven. So I fell in love with the alpine, and I worked up there in the summer, and then I got a job on the parks and built the Singing Pass Trail, and I was just into having a great job in the outdoors.
And so then what happened to you after Ski Patrol?
Got lucky and had a beautiful daughter. So it was like I was making $5 an hour, so I needed to do something different. So that was in the 80s, and it started to look like Whistler was going to be something, and real estate might be a good thing to get into. So I studied real estate and got my license, and then kind of kept the ski patrolling going on the side and did real estate. After 86, I think, is when I got my license, 86, 87.
Wow. So if you started in real estate in the 80s, you saw a huge development from those little trailers at the bottom of Creekside for staff accommodation to what Whistler is now.
The progression was amazing because there was no, it was called Alta Lake when I arrived here.
Mm-hmm.
And then we formed the municipality, and then the village was built, and then it started to, you know, become more of a plan, I guess. And we saw that all develop, and it was so interesting. I like the politics because we were all involved. We were big fish in a little pond, you know, sort of thing. So it was kind of fun to be part of the development in a sense, even though I was just a young guy trying to figure out how to make a living. But I just loved the way Whistler was developing.
Neat. So you really got to see that valley, which you described as ugly at the beginning, really change and open
it's beautiful
up
now.
To people.
Yes,
yeah.
It's a beautiful place. It's amazing what, you know, $20 billion will do.
If only I had $20 billion.
And that's just the real estate.
Yeah, totally, totally. So tell me a little bit about why you've decided to create a podcast.
I want to record an oral history with the people that I know, that I'm close to, that I know stories about in the development. And, you know, as we were young, crazy hippies, and we developed into, you know, family people and then into business people, and now we're at the senior level. I know all these people, and they have so many great stories. And so I think I can hopefully draw those out of people and kind of record that oral history of Whistler, not just what people would write down and say, this is what happened at a certain time. What about those times where, you know, you didn't know what was going to happen, you just had a good time, and it was a great place to live. And that's why people come here to Whistler. It's about the culture. You know?
So there's a little bit about bringing out that Whistler culture, having that local culture come through in the storytelling. I think storytelling is really important. I think you've got some interesting stories to tell.
Yeah, well,
share.
Anyone who lived here back in the 70s or even earlier has got lots of great stories. I mean, there's some real, iconic, historical, people that have made history here, We were so young and there was so much opportunity and lots of people grabbed a hold of those opportunities and made lots of progress because it was a blank slate in those days. And we thought, this is going to take shape. And I remember when Blackcomb was bought or developed and sitting in the patrol room and our leader going, you know what? Our community is going to change now. Mm. We got another mountain. Mm. It's just going to be twice as big. So we just exploded. And then, the village and the village north and the benchlands.
Interesting. I'm really excited about your podcast and who you're going to have on.
Yeah, well, hopefully people will like to tell their stories. I know a few that do, but maybe, I don't want to get too personal.
So what kind of topics were we thinking about for your podcast?
Well, there's so many different people. And lifties, bartenders, managers, presidents, CEOs, investors. There's just so many, artists, so many interesting people in this town. And they all came, for the mountain. They didn't come to get rich. They don't get rich. It's a place where you have to love to be a part of and lucky too. So people are going to hopefully show us why they stayed here and why they contributed. And that will be why Whistler is great.
I'm really interested to hear a little bit about some of your stories. Tell me a little bit about your history with Ski Patrol and what happened to form CARDA.
Yeah, the dog Rescue Dog Association was a big part of my life, obviously.
Yeah.
And that has a history that goes back, a very personal kind of experience that I've had. And, people don't realize when you're working on the mountain, people want to complain, oh, the lifts aren't open, oh, the service isn't good. Mm. But the people are out there giving blood, sweat, and tears all the time. And I've lost a number of friends working on the mountain. Mm. And it made us think about safety, seriously. And I was, studying snow science in the early days with the National Research Council. We were doing all sorts of cool things, like taking pictures of snow crystals and stuff. It was kind of cool. And so that was sort of my focus. And then I got caught in a big avalanche and buried. And another visiting patroller from Snowbird, our very first exchange, was totally buried. And luckily, we had lots of patrollers around when we got buried. So I got dug out right away. I had a hand sticking out. And we didn't have any rescue equipment with us in those days because, the mountain was cheap and we were poor. And we were just throwing bombs and going in crazy places and learning step by step. So we finally found Rick Mandel, who was buried for like 7 minutes or 10 minutes. And he like should have been dead. But we kept screaming his name and digging him out. And we found him buried under about 5 feet, maybe 3 or 4 feet of snow, found his pack, figured out where the top was or the bottom, found his toque, took his toque off. His head was blue, so he was hypoxic. And when he found his mouth, scooped snow out of his mouth, and he started breathing. Well, we saved him. It was like, wow, we have our lucky. I lived, he lived, and I lost some equipment and whatnot. So it made me think about being safer and covering your butt in as many ways as we could. So the safety supervisor at the time told me, a dog would be a good idea to have here, like on site, an avalanche dog, because Snowbird had dogs at that point.
Oh, yeah.
And Alta had Snowbird, were the first guys, I think, in the States to have avalanche rescue dogs. And there were 4 people that had been buried earlier, like in 67 or 68, I think. There was 4 people killed in the Harmony Horseshoe. They didn't have transceivers or anything, and they couldn't even find where they were for days. But RCMP dogs found them eventually. So the kind of seed had been planted. So I took the initiative, found out what I should do and how I should do it, wrote a report, and went to the president, Franz Wilhelmsen, in his big office downtown on House Street. President of Whistler.
Of Whistler.
Yeah, the original first president. Mm. And it was his idea to build Whistler. Mm. And so he had a big office down on Howe Street, and I had to go down there and with my, and give my presentation to him. But he was in full support of what I was doing. So that was great. And so that's where it kind of started. I asked what kind of dog I needed, how to go about it, who to talk to, what to read. I really didn't know anything. And
what kind of dog did you need?
The German Shepherd dog was the best dog, apparently, according to the police. Mm. And the police have the mandate for all search and rescue in Canada.
Okay.
Which turned out to be the best thing that could have happened to our association because it's an arm's length validation system.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, it means like they're police and they're used to being urban people, so mm-hmm. they didn't know really the mountains as mm-hmm. well as, say, a ski patroller would. Now, Parks Canada, who had the only other avalanche-trained dogs in Canada, they were good mountaineers and were rescue-trained, mm-hmm. so they trained the RCMP. But the RCMP actually had to validate the dogs for Parks. Parks had to validate the RCMP for their mountaineering skills.
Interesting.
So it's a national body at arm's length, mm-hmm. and government run. So that was unique in Canada. And I went to the course and made it through the course. Got a letter from the RCMP saying that I'd made it through the course. And that was a criteria that Franz wanted, that I was legally allowed to go onto these avalanche sites with my dog. Mm-hmm. So I did get that. It took me about 4 years to go through all of the... That's how CARTA started.
Wow.
And we used that formula for the parks. They can... Parks or a mountain guide will certify our handlers in their mountaineering skills and rescue skills. And then the RCMP validates the dogs and the handlers in their skills. Now, it's much more complicated than it was back 40 years ago, but it's grown. And the reason it's been very successful is because it's a national organization. We're way ahead of them in the States as far as a very credible national organization.
It sounds far more efficient. What do they do with the dogs? Do they start them off as puppies?
Yeah, the puppies... start out at 6 months, you pick a dog that's not going to be shy of loud noises. It's got a very good prey instinct, wants to go find stuff and play and be rough and have fun. And, you know, so you got to have characteristics that are good for the dog. So you look for that kind of thing in a dog, and you can do that through breeding, you know, and that's why the German Shepherd, who was used exclusively in Europe for a long time and quite a bit, in the States and Canada and in the armed forces and everything else. Now they have different breeds like Belgian Malinois that have got more aggression and more high strung, but you've got to be awesome handler to be able to handle those kind of dogs.
Mm.
But anyway, it's any working dog. Any working dog will go and find you because they love to do that. Dogs love to find people, and we make it fun and train to that degree. So yeah, that's the way it works. And then we have like three courses every year. We have a puppy course to tell if the dog is trainable.
Okay.
And then we have a winter course that trains those dogs to search in the snow. And then we validate other handlers in that general course. And then we have an advanced course, which is more mountaineering and high alpine rescue and overnight camping and all that kind of stuff for senior dog handlers.
Nice.
So there's three kind of levels, and it takes a couple of years to get validated.
And so then the dogs have shifts, or how does it work once they're validated and they're working on the mountain?
Well, we used to have four or five dogs on each mountain. Mm-hmm. And the ideal is to have two dogs on each mountain, Black Comb and Whistler, mm-hmm. Every working day. But, you know, I mean, it's so hard for people once you've had a dog and you realize how much it takes and how much money it costs and all that kind of stuff. People, there's attrition. People come into the organization and they go. But over the years, we've had some great, I mean, we've got handlers that have had four or five dogs.
Wow.
And it's a lifetime thing. So ideally, you know, there's a dog at least one dog on the mountain every day, you know, just in case there's a freak accident and, you know, or they go into the backcountry. But they work with search and rescue and RCMP, so they're available to fly anywhere in the province if they're needed.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. And what's CARTA doing now? So in terms of, They obviously need funding.
Funding's always a hard thing. And the lottery corporation funds us quite heavily, which is great.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
We get like $100,000 a year from the lottery corporation. That's why I don't mind buying tickets.
Okay. Funding Carta.
I'm funding my Carta, habit. It's great to have them. But it takes some organizing and some, bureaucratic stuff, and you've got to, we're a nonprofit organization. We've got to be very careful about what we spend our money on and how we record it and everything like that. But it's an amazing step from where I was when I knew nothing to where we are today.
Wow.
And we have many handler dog teams. I think maybe about 25 or 30 in the province now.
Wow.
And that's, there's about 50 members in Carta, which are associate members and past members and whatnot. I think we've trained maybe close to 200 dogs over the 40 years.
Wow.
And they got to get validated every year, according to the RCMP standards. So
that's a big thing.
It costs money to put on a course. It costs money to go to a course. It costs money to keep your dog trained. It's a big responsibility. So who knows what we were getting into at the time, but it's turned out to be quite a fulfilling endeavor for sure.
Yeah. So that's
my dog thing.
But I was going to say that's just your hobby.
It's sort of a hobby. I don't even have a dog now, and it's like I love dogs so much. Lots of my friends have dogs, and they know that I love them. It's funny how dogs can sense.
Totally.
Yeah. So and I go to the courses and I hang out, and I've got old techniques and whatnot, but they still give me the respect. I'm a lifetime member there, so that's cool. And so they think I'm the old guy from the past, but they let me come to the courses and hang out. So it's great.
I don't think they let you. I think they like to have you.
I'm sure they do.
So Carta, Canadian Avalanche Rescue Dog Association. Mm-hmm. There's a website.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
Carta.
Carta.ca.
If people want to find out more about that. Mm-hmm. And we didn't even touch on real estate.
No, that's the other part of my life. and that was the development part of Whistler. Where it's like real estate heaven, just starts out with nothing, dirt roads, no sewers, no TV, no radio, nothing. So we had to be friendly, So that's where all these friendships came from.
Amazing.
And they're still friends, I've had friends, lifelong friends here. It's great. So I want to get the stories out of them before they forget.
I want to get those stories out of them too, similar to what you just told us about Carta and the beginning of that. I want to get out some ski patrol stories, and I'm really excited for your podcast and to see who you have on and what they have to say about Whistler.
Yeah.
Me
too.
Those secret Whistler stories. Well, thanks.
Come on,
Bruce.
Tell me. Yeah, you can talk. It's okay. Nobody will know. No. Yeah. It's good to record these things. And lots of people said, I'm going to write a book. But, nobody does.
You know what?
It's better to talk.
This is better.
Yeah.
This is better. Tell me your most inspiring memory about when you were working with Carta.
Oh, when we did the live recovery. There's one live recovery with a dog in Canada. And it was in Fernie. And it was a floppy-eared dog. And it was...
What does that mean?
Well, it wasn't a German Shepherd. Oh. Everybody gave me a hard time. Oh, you got to have a German Shepherd. You can't beat my dog because he's working. And that was a hard thing to get over. But this fellow, he was training to be a lifty. And he got off his designated run, skied into an area he shouldn't have been, skied up to some patrollers. And the patroller said, what are you doing here? And he said, well, I'm just skiing out. So you're not supposed to be here. Do you have any avalanche rescue gear on you? No. And at that moment, almost, an avalanche came down. He started to ski away. An avalanche came down and caught him and buried him. And so they didn't have any way of finding him because he didn't have a transceiver. So they called for the dog that was down in the valley. The dog got on a skidoo with another guy, brought him up. And the ski patrol director was the dog handler. And he basically just let the dog work around because they were probing and trying to, do a hasty search, looking at her, things that were on the avalanche debris. And the dog just started digging, and he found a glove, and he flipped that glove into the air, and they went, wow, that must be a person there. So they dug down. And I don't know how long he was under, but he was under quite a time, a while.
Wow.
And they found him. And that was the first live recovery of an avalanche victim with a dog. That was in 2001.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was a defining memory for Carta, for sure. And that took, 20 years to get done. But we search for bodies most of the time, but we also search for wilderness people. And lately, the greatest memory lately is the fellas that were caught in the climbing. They were in Alberta, and they weren't wearing transceivers.
Mm.
And an avalanche came down, and it was very dangerous. So they had a new technique where they had the helicopter tied to the dog and handler. And,
wow.
And the helicopter was hovering with downwash, so it makes no wind. It's just throwing all the scent down into the snow again. And the dog was tied to the handler, as he would be in any glacier for safety. But the handler's tied to the helicopter. And he found those three victims in 38 minutes.
Wow.
Which is phenomenal. So it just shows you how professional we've become.
Wow.
In Carta. So those are two really defining memories.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, I'm really excited to hear more memories from you and from your guests.
About the parties and the crazy times.
And some more serious things. I mean, throwing bombs is interesting, too.
It's fun. Yeah, it's real fun.
So
yeah.
I'd like to hear about that, and looking forward to your next podcast.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks for being here, Bruce.
No, thank you.